Is ketamine a glutamate antagonist or a spiritual kindler? Ketamine has two origin stories, each with its own understanding of how it treats depression. One came from the East, and one came from the West. And after the Iron Curtain came down, the two met face to face. Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Who do you turn to when your patient doesn't respond to antidepressants, psychotherapy, TMS, and a long list of antidepressant augmenters like lithium, atypical antipsychotics, methylfolate, and thyroid? Some of you might say ECT, and some might say ketamine. And in this month's journal, we feature a landmark study, the first randomized control trial to compare these two giants. And while ECT has been used in psychiatry since the 1930s and ketamine since the year 2000, we still don't understand exactly how these treatments work. ECT seems to require seizures, but it also has neuroprotective effects, increasing brain-derived neurotrophic factor and enhancing dopamine signaling. And ketamine, well, today we'll focus on that one. John Krystal published the first clinical trial of ketamine in depression. He is now the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Yale Medical School, and he comes from a family of notable psychiatrists who have changed how we practice today. His twin brother, Andy Krystal, helped develop the Z hypnotics, and he was responsible for many of the studies on hypnotics and depression that we covered last April. His father, the late Henry Krystal, was a psychoanalyst and Holocaust survivor who helped develop our current conceptualization of PTSD and new psychotherapeutic approaches to this disorder.
In the 1990s, the monoamines, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, were seen as a panacea for anxiety and depression. But John Krystal wasn't satisfied with them. He was seeing a lot of partial cures and treatment failures on these medications, and he didn't think that simply boosting monoamines was what treated depression. That was just their initial effect, but their antidepressant benefits came on weeks later. Other research pointed to downstream effects of these medications that might better explain their actions, such as changes in neurotrophic factors or glutamate transmission in the cortical limbic pathways. It was in these pathways between the cortex and limbic system that the symptoms of depression were thought to lie, and the monoamines were not even the major players there, but glutamate was. Other glutamatergic or NMDA antagonists like lamotrigine, D-cycloserine, and amantadine were showing antidepressant potential. And maybe ketamine, yes, the anesthetic agent that became a drug of abuse in the Vietnam era, could treat depression through its glutamatergic properties. Krystal already had some experience with ketamine. Since the early 90s, he had been using it to model schizophrenia and alcohol withdrawal. I was actually a medical student at Yale when I saw recruitment posters from his lab for a study that would model schizophrenia by giving normal subjects ketamine. I was tempted. I thought this was a great opportunity for a future psychiatrist. It would help me empathize with psychotic patients. I ran the idea by my advisor, though, and he kindly shut it down. You have no idea what ketamine could do long term. And you don't need to be psychotic to empathize with your patients. You just need to listen and try to understand them. I'm still grateful for that advice. In the late 1990s, Krystal tested ketamine in depressed patients in a randomized controlled trial of 7 patients. He wasn't expecting a breakthrough. He was just looking to test a theory. But the results surprised him. Here's how he recalls it.
To the amazement of our patients and ourselves, we found that ketamine produced rapid, profound, and surprisingly durable antidepressant effects that were temporally dissociated from the brief acute behavioral effects of the drug. In other words, the initial euphoria produced by ketamine was not a part of its antidepressant effect.
In Krystal's view, the initial euphoria that ketamine produced, the thing that made people take it to get high, was an unwanted side effect that was unrelated to the more lasting antidepressant effects it produced. Likewise, the dissociation and psychotic-like sensations that ketamine produced were also unwanted side effects. But researchers in the former Soviet Union also tested ketamine earlier, in the 1980s, and they arrived at a very different view of its mechanism. Let's go back to 1985 to see how things looked from the East. Dr. Igor Kungerstev wanted to help people break free from addiction. Working as a psychiatrist at the Bekhterev Psychoneurological Research Institute in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, he saw many Russians whose lives were ruined by drink, and he had a novel idea. He had heard from his anesthesia colleagues that patients sometimes had near-death experiences after taking ketamine before surgery. The reaction was frightening, and he wondered if he could create an aversive reaction to alcohol by pairing ketamine with a stiff drink. The patients would come to associate alcohol with dying and, he hoped, would never want to touch the bottle again.
But the experiment backfired. Instead of frightening the patients, ketamine triggered something mystical in them. They started writing poetry, painting, and reading spiritual texts for the first time. Some became intrigued by nature and went frolicking in the forest. Some spoke of encounters with Jesus Christ, which was particularly puzzling since this was a Soviet Union and religious activity was suppressed by the state.
To better understand what was happening, Dr. Kungerstev tried ketamine on himself, and this time he got the effect he was looking for, unfortunately. He felt his sense of self dissolve and his consciousness disappear, but it didn't inspire poetry. It made him panic.
The most unusual feeling was that I had no body, yet somehow I existed. The next development was indescribable. During the first stage, I seemed to exist only as a point of consciousness, but still I existed. Then there was a stage where even this disembodied sense of self began to disappear, and I felt a real terror of dying.
He tried it again and found that by surrendering to the experience, he was able to get some of the benefits his patients were finding with ketamine. He came out of it with a new sense of his place in the universe and a deeper sense of Buddhist concepts that he had previously only understood intellectually. Later, Dr. Kungerstev noticed that patients with type A obsessive-compulsive personality styles did feel uncomfortable with the loss of conscious control that ketamine brought.
One of the qualities of successful people is that they pivot, quickly revising their strategy when things go wrong or new information suggests a change of course. And that is what Dr. Kungerstev did. Ketamine was not going to be the aversive conditioner he was looking for, but maybe there was potential in this altered state it induced. He tried using hypnotic suggestion while patients were under the influence of ketamine, dropping hints that they should give up alcohol. That didn't work, so he pivoted again and developed a form of ketamine-assisted psychotherapy that capitalized on the ketamine-induced transcendent state to help his patients achieve sobriety. He found similar success with anxiety and depression. He called it death rebirth psychotherapy, and it was based on the idea that the ketamine experience gave patients a new sense of purpose, one that could move them beyond depression or alcoholism, and a deeper understanding of life and death. In the Western view, the out-of-body experiences and illusions of tunnels were psychiatric side effects labeled dissociation. The state of self-transcendence was simply a temporary euphoria unrelated to the drug's mechanism. But in the East, these experiences were integral to the therapy.
He found that ketamine gave patients a new perspective on life, death, and their relationships. Here's how he described it.
Ketamine seems to increase the capacity for detached observation. Some went back to their families. They noticed problems in their relationships or certain idiosyncrasies of their spouses and relatives, which they were unaware of before treatment.
Kungerstev was joined by a colleague, Yevgeny Krupitsky, and through the 1980s they refined the technique, finding, for example, that the ketamine experience was enhanced if the patient listened to New Age music while receiving the intravenous dose. One of Dr. Kungersdev's strangest observations concerned his encounter with a band of Soviet mystics. It's pretty hard to summarize this one, so we'll just quote him directly.
"I would also like to relate some unusual anecdotes connected with our research. About 1 year after we began our study, a group composed of 2 men and 1 woman appeared at our hospital who were very strange looking, wore strange clothes, and had strange, shiny eyes that seemed out of focus. They called themselves magicians and said that they sensed in their meditations and magic practice that in this hospital, some people were throwing other souls into the astral plane. They had come to see what we were doing, like astral police. Prior to this, we had not published the results of our work, and only a few professionals knew about it. Also, this hospital is situated in the suburbs of St. Petersburg and is not widely known. So we described our work and showed them our hospital. They approved. They also told us that they themselves use ketamine for their underground magic practice."
These astral police supplied the doctor with textbooks of psychedelic medicine that they had smuggled into the Soviet Union, and he was grateful, as he wasn't able to find them on his own. And they also gave him one thing more, a mushroom plant that Dr. Kungersdev had only read about, psilocybin. He took the mushroom, and here's what transpired.
"I noticed that my usual stream of thoughts, my inner dialogue, had stopped. Sensations of the body became more precise. My awareness and mindfulness were strong and lucid. I was absolutely here now, in every moment. I noticed that when I began to do something, I was fully involved in the action, forgetting all else. At the same time, I felt an inner surrender from all actions. The experience was gently going deeper. I felt myself miraculously serene and in a contemplative mood. I had no desires and needs. I simply was. Bodily sensations became blissful. Pure existence. The world is perfect. All happens in the proper way. There is nothing to improve, nothing to add, and nothing to take off, just to be."
Death rebirth psychotherapy continues in Russia, though the name has been changed to the more innocuous ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And the central ideal of guiding people through a drug-induced consciousness-changing state is now knocking on the door of the mainstream, as psilocybin and MDMA-assisted psychotherapy are undergoing Phase 3 trials for FDA approval. And we don't mean to imply here that this is an Eastern idea. Listen to our podcast from 2 weeks ago to hear how psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy got its start in 1950s America.
Dr. Kungertsev's and Krupitsky's work on ketamine was unknown in the West. The Iron Curtain was pretty thick in those days and didn't start to crumble until the more open policies of Gorbachev's perestroika and the final collapse in August 1991. A few months later, Dr. Kungersdev published the first descriptions of his work, but he did so in an obscure journal of psychedelic research, the Albert Hofmann Foundation Bulletin, and it was written in a style quite out of sync with the rigorous objectivity of a scientific paper. But Yevgeny Krupitsky went further with the work, blending the Eastern and Western views of ketamine after the fall of the Soviet Union.
In 1994, Dr. Krupitsky went on a tour of the United States, visiting psychiatry departments from New Mexico to the NIH to speak on his ketamine therapy. At the end of his visit, he met with John Kristol at Yale. Kristol was beginning his research on ketamine at the time, and the two worked out a plan to collaborate on research together on ketamine and alcohol use disorders. Dr. Krupitsky returned to Yale a few years later in 1997, where he spent a full year working in Dr. Kristol's lab, conducting research on ketamine and alcohol. We asked Dr. Kristol if the Russian experience of ketamine-assisted therapy inspired any of his work on ketamine and depression, and he said that it did not. He recalls his meeting with Dr. Krupitsky this way.
"I learned what I know about ketamine psychedelic therapy from him. I gleaned from Dr. Krupitsky that KPT was used to treat a variety of clinical conditions. The treatment procedure seemed to involve inducing a highly dissociated state. In this state, people may perceive the world through a perceptual tunnel. that they called a near-death state. They employed a form of psychotherapy that created the expectation that their patients were being reborn. This rebirthing was believed to be an important part of the treatment. We took a very different approach. From the outset, we were probing neural mechanisms. When we administered ketamine to patients, we prepared them for what they could expect to experience during drug administration. However, we did not suggest that the subjective effects of ketamine were part of the treatment.
Dr. Krupitsky credits his visits to the U.S. with helping him develop controlled double-blind methodology to test out his ideas. Since his return to Russia, he has gone on to publish pivotal controlled trials of ketamine as well as naltrexone in opioid use disorders. These competing views of ketamine are particularly relevant today as we move closer to a world where medications like psilocybin and MDMA are used to create novel experiences that, when paired with psychotherapy, can heal psychiatric disorders. So we took a deeper dive into the literature on ketamine to see what we could learn.
Carlos Cerati's work at the NIMH adds to the story. He looked at how ketamine affects the default mode network, the part of the brain that is responsible for self-consciousness, as well as all of that negative self-talk that we call depressive rumination. Ketamine normalizes circuits in the default mode network, quieting all that depressive chatter, although the effect only lasts about 10 days. Here's how a patient describes it from a documentary by Vice.
I think because I've been able to subdue a lot of that and kill the chatter per se, it's allowed me to function and be more happy and not have to think like that, actually.
It lets you kind of encapsulate all those things in your life, right? All your feelings, your relationships, your upbringing, all those other things, like sort of ball into one thing, and you sort of set it over there. And you're just walking around, and you're just looking at them. You don't have an emotional reaction or attachment or something to each image or each experience that you see.
A 2018 study suggests that the drug's glutamatergic actions enable these changes in the default mode network. Mindfulness meditation and behavioral activation also normalize default mode activity. And when the default mode shuts off, people experience out-of-body sensations of the type we hear about in near-death experiences. So far, sounds like the Russians were onto something.
But not all of the evidence points in this direction. Dissociation, for example, appears to be just a side effect of ketamine. It does not predict the drug's antidepressant effects, according to the most recent studies. We've spoken today of some of the promise of ketamine. Like psilocybin, ketamine might treat depression in part by bringing patients to a new state of consciousness. But the human brain is complex, and all medications have the potential to do good and harm once they get in there. In the case of ketamine, those harms are exemplified by its potential to induce psychosis and its long history as a drug of abuse. When ketamine is taken at high doses for prolonged periods of time, as it is when people abuse it, ketamine has neurotoxic effects on brain cells and can cause serious damage to the bladder. And while we've talked today about ketamine, we assume that most everything we've said will apply to S-ketamine, Spravato, as well, as that is just an isomer of ketamine. So ketamine contains the Spravato isomer.
And now for the word of the day, number needed to treat.
The number needed to treat, or NNT, is the number of patients you would need to treat in order to have a specific impact on one person. In psychiatry, that impact is usually response, which is defined as a 50% reduction in symptoms, or remission, which is when symptoms fall to within a normal level on a standardized rating scale, even if they don't go away 100%. You can use the number needed to treat to compare the relative efficacy of different treatments. Here are some benchmarks, and lower numbers are better. Most treatments in psychiatry have a number needed to treat around 3 to 8. Of course, the all-powerful placebo effect is subtracted out of that number, and that accounts for about half of the response for many psychiatric treatments. So if they say that a number needed to treat is 4, and you're getting much better results in your practice, in other words, you get more than 1 out of 4 patients better, you can bet that a lot of that is the placebo and the natural course of the illness. When the number needed to treat goes above 10, the treatment is considered pretty weak, and the FDA would need some strong convincing to approve it. At the more powerful end are stimulants in ADHD, lithium for prevention in bipolar disorder, and ketamine and ECT in depression, all of which have numbers needed to treat around 3. Next week, we'll tell you about a genetic test that has a number needed to treat of 3, a remarkable feat for any psychiatric intervention, and particularly for a genetic test, as most of them barely register on the efficacy scale when it comes to making a difference in depression.
Read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarlattreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST. That helps us stay free of influence from the pharmaceutical industry and bring you unbiased information you can trust.
Remember Henry Crystal, Dr. Crystal's father? Well, he passed away in 2015 at the age of 90. But we found some of his lectures at the Carter Jenkins Center, which has a rich resource of psychoanalytic lectures online. Here's Dr. Crystal speaking on the role of alexithymia, or the inability to feel one's own emotions, in PTSD.
I would like to consider therapeutic approaches with traumatized patients. Many of them show alexithymia, psychosomatic, and addictive problems in addition to the PTSD. Unmodified traditional psychoanalytic technique does not work well with these people. I maintain that alexithymia is one of the most common causes of poor outcome of psychoanalysis. Many such patients know all our interpretations by heart, but retain their problems and symptoms hardly altered. I hope that the application of the principles I'm about to review can help prevent such sorry outcomes. The healing message to the alexithymic patients, which is very hard for them to experience and feel, is that love is real and that it works. They have a difficult time imagining that. They cannot believe it. They demand instant wish fulfillment. Their view on this matter is, if you loved me, everything would feel perfect. Since it doesn't, then you too are offering me counterfeit nurturance. And this I've been getting all of my life.